Good day. Today is Monday, 27th July 2026, and before I proceed with this programme, let me remind you to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel. Well, today there have been reports of further important developments on the battlefronts, but I'm going to start with what appear to be new flickers of diplomatic activity coming from the United States, or maybe they're not so much new, maybe they've been underway for some time and just haven't been reported properly. But we now have a report from Reuters which says that that Ukraine and the United States, the intelligence agencies of these two countries and presumably other officials of these two countries, are working on a joint proposal which they intend to present to the Russians, which appears to call for what might be described, or what they will describe, as a ceasefire in the war in the sky, or perhaps more accurately and more precisely, a no-fly zone for the Russians over the skies over Ukraine. Now, this has been discussed, as I said, in Reuters, and the Reuters dispatch speaks of a plan whereby each side agrees that they will conduct no further strikes on the territory of the other, so that Ukraine will cease its drone offensive against Russia, and Russia will cease its drone and missile offensive against Ukraine. And at the same time, there will be a cessation of bombing by the Russian Air Force of Ukrainian positions, with Russian aircraft dropping these immensely powerful Fab bombs, which are having a massive effect on the battlefronts, as I discussed in my program yesterday. Now, this is all discussed in Reuters, and according to Reuters, this proposal has not yet been put to the Russians. And this morning, the Russian president's spokesman, Dmitry Peskov, in the Kremlin, was asked to comment about this Reuters report, and he said that the Russians are aware of this report, but no formal proposal of that nature has been put to them, and the Russians consider this all to be speculative gossip and are not going to discuss or comment upon it further until some proposal of that nature is indeed presented to them. Now, Peskov is not being entirely forthcoming here, because this proposal has actually been floating around for some time. And I say this because back, I believe it was at the SPIEF conference in St. Petersburg, back in May, or was it June, Vladimir Putin himself disclosed the fact that various new ideas had been sent in the Russians' direction, one of which was for precisely this kind of ceasefire in the sky, and that there was no possibility, at least he seemed utterly dismissive of the proposal, and made the obvious point, which I have made in program after program, that there is simply no comparison between the Ukrainian strikes on Russia and the immeasurably more devastating strikes that Russia has been inflicting upon Ukraine. So, on the face of it, and based on what Putin was saying then, and this is some months ago now, about about a month and a half ago, Putin has already rejected this proposal, and I suspect that the words from Peskov, which were hardly encouraging to anybody in the United States who wants to put forward a proposal of this kind. Peskov's reaction suggests again that the response from the Russians is going to be a straightforward no. And well, this of course comes on top of a statement by the US President himself, Donald Trump, about a week or 10 days ago, in which he also floated the possibility of security guarantees for Ukraine, which would extend to a no-fly zone over Ukrainian territory. So President Trump seemed to be floating the idea of a no-fly zone at some point in time. And well, we've also had that very strange, very difficult meeting between Lavrov and Rubio in Manila, which I've discussed extensively. It remains my opinion that the primary reason Rubio wanted to meet with Lavrov was to discuss the media reports about Russia providing military assistance to Iran and trying to get Russia to agree to end that assistance. As I've discussed in previous programs, Lavrov, if he was asked for this, would have given it short shrift. And frankly, if you've been following Lavrov's commentaries thereafter, that's certainly the impression he's been giving. But beyond that, I wonder whether Rubio also floated the ceasefire plan to Lavrov in Manila. I've discussed that this appears to have been a very contentious meeting, with Lavrov reading out to Rubio the detailed documentary history about the summit meeting between Trump and Putin in Anchorage last year, and going out of his way to correct Rubio's assertion that no agreement had been reached between Trump and Putin in Anchorage. In fact, Lavrov appears to have come very close to have told Rubio in the meeting in Manila that in denying that there had been a meeting, an agreement in Anchorage, Rubio was flat out lying. But Rubio, for his part, said that whatever was discussed in Anchorage is now past history. It's obviously not going to happen. It's not going to work. So it's time for new ideas. And I wonder whether Rubio also may have floated this idea of a ceasefire in the skies to Lavrov over the course of this meeting, in which case Lavrov will definitely also have given it short shrift. So I say all of this because, of course, what is actually being proposed is not so much a mutual ceasefire in the sky, because, as I said, the reality is that the balance in terms of who is carrying out the greater damage to whom is massively lopsided in the Russians' favour. It is rather a case of the Americans trying to persuade the Russians to agree to a no-fly zone over Ukraine, which would, of course, dramatically change the military balance. One of the key advantages that the Russians have in the sky over Ukraine is that their air force is operating and is able to drop fab bombs. And I have myself in previous programs pushed back on claims that the Ukrainian drones have been anywhere near as effective as some people have been saying in holding back the Russians on the front lines. Anyway, I firmly predict, in fact, I am absolutely sure that the Russians, if they are ever going to be presented with this proposal, are going to reject it. In fact, there is no doubt that they are going to reject it for all of the reasons that I have said. The Russians continue their massive missile and drone strikes over Ukraine. They've been continuing to bombard Odessa relentlessly. Odessa and the surrounding ports were bombed and missiles and drone striked again heavily over the course of last night. And the Russians are also methodically destroying gasoline filling stations across central and eastern Ukraine and are attacking other targets in eastern and central Ukraine. And the Russians are also attacking military industrial facilities in Kiev itself. And their strikes on Kiev appear to be edging closer and closer to the city centre, where at least some of the decision-making centres are probably located, just saying. So all of this is going on, and I can't myself imagine that this is anything other than part of the overall plan drawn up by the General Staff to achieve victory in Ukraine. And agreeing to a no-fly zone would contradict that plan and would give the Ukrainians an advantage. And it's inconceivable to me that the Russians would agree to a proposal of this kind. Besides, as I said, in his comments, I believe it was in Spiff, Putin already appeared to dismiss the whole idea. So the question is, why are the Americans coming up with this proposal again at this particular point in the conflict? A proposal which the Russians, in effect, have already rejected, and which they repeatedly rejected, by the way, also when it was first put before them last year. Well, I suspect that there are two reasons for this. Firstly, I suspect that one of the purposes of the Ukrainian drone offensive, which, to be clear, is an American-Ukrainian drone offensive, the Americans are providing the technology, they're providing the satellite data, they're providing through Starlink the guidance. One of the purposes of the American drone offensive, the American-Ukrainian drone offensive against Ukraine, was to try to push the Russians towards ending the attacks on Ukraine from the sky, to hurt the Russians as much as possible in a way that would compel the Russians, supposedly, or persuade the Russians, as the Americans might say, or coerce the Russians, as others might say, into agreeing to this ceasefire in the sky, which the Russians have consistently rejected. A subtext of all Western proposals made to Russia is that if the Russians don't agree to the proposal, the Western side will escalate. And a subtext to all Western debates about whether or not to escalate in the war against Russia, and that is basically what it is that if the Russians, if there isn't escalation, that will take the pressure off the Russians to come to the negotiating table and capitulate to whatever demands the Western powers are making. The West tends overwhelmingly to think in this way, that the Russians can either be bribed or bullied into agreeing to Western demands. Bribed, which is what President Trump repeatedly did last year, dangling in front of the Russians proposals for sanctions relief and glittering economic deals and tunnels under the Bering Strait and all of that, and bullied when the bribes don't work, which is, of course, exactly what we see now. It's very much, if I may say, consistent with the profoundly cynical view of Russia that Western leaders invariably have an inability to take the Russians seriously and to accept that the Russians mean what they say, and bafflement and fury when the bribes are offered or the bullying takes place, and then the offer for, in effect, capitulation is made, and the Russians come back and say no. So this is just following exactly that pattern. But I think that there is another side to this, which is that about 3 weeks ago, Zelensky, before the crisis in Kiev, consequent upon the dismissal of Ukraine's defense minister Mykhailo Fyodorov, took place, gave instructions to the Ukrainian military and intelligence agencies to mount a 40-day offensive against the Russians, to force the Russians to the negotiating table. Well, I believe we are about three quarters of the way through that offensive, just say. And clearly, as it now seems to me, one of its purposes was to force the Russians to agree to this ceasefire proposal. Except that it hasn't forced the Russians to this ceasefire proposal. On the contrary, the Russians have absorbed and countered the blows. The Ukrainian drone offensive has been gradually losing effectiveness. I will come to that later. I'm not saying that it has been rendered totally ineffective, but it has been losing effectiveness. Whereas the Russian bombing and missile campaign against Ukraine has been inflicting body blows on Ukraine itself, such as the closure of Ukraine's Black Sea ports and the collapse of its maritime trade. And there's also, of course, been the accumulating disasters on the front lines, starting maybe with the fall of Konstantinovka, but as I will discuss shortly in this program, these disasters are now mounting. So, whereas perhaps the hope was that after 40 days, the Russians would be pleading for a stop and agreeing to no-fly zones like the ones that I've discussed, the fact that the Russians haven't done so, and that Ukraine is being even more battered, and the Russians are advancing faster, means that the Ukrainians and the Americans, who must at some level be aware of what is happening, have decided to move forward and to push diplomatically harder with this, I'm going to call it from now on, no-fly zone proposal. Well, I don't know what is going to happen. There's been endless talk throughout this year of Witkoff and Kushner coming back to Moscow. The last time they were there, by the way, was in January, where they had a rather chilly meeting with Vladimir Putin. This is, of course, shortly after the drone attack on his residence in Valdai, which the Russians believe was an assassination attempt in which the United States might have colluded. Anyway, there's been endless talk that Witkoff and Kushner might be returning to Moscow with new proposals. I wonder whether this is the proposal that they're going to come with, in which case the Russian reception is not going to be chilly, it's going to be icy. Anyway, there we are. Now, to anyone who has any doubts that Putin is in no mood to agree to these kind of ceasefire ideas, I would suggest that they go to the Kremlin's website and read the various comments and statements that Putin made over the course of a meeting with senior Russian naval officers in the Admiralty building in St. Petersburg. All of the top naval chiefs were there, all of the heads of the various Russian fleets, the Baltic Fleet, the Black Sea Fleet, the Northern Fleet, and the Far Eastern Fleet, and the Pacific Fleet, and of course the Caspian Sea Flotilla. They were all there, and the leadership of the Navy was there too. The Admiral Moiseev, who is the overall head of the Russian Navy, and Belousov, the defense minister, was there as well. And this meeting took place to commemorate Navy Day. And by the way, I just forgot to mention another person who was there was Nikolai Patrushev, Putin's former national security advisor, who is now the official who is in overall charge of Russia's naval build-up and who is supervising Russia's naval construction, as well as the building up of Russia's shipbuilding, own civilian shipbuilding industry. Anyway, Putin came to this meeting in a completely uncompromising mood. One of the naval officers, over the course of this meeting, spoke to him about how all of them are committed to seeing the special operation concluded through a complete victory. Putin endorsed this. He said that he believed absolutely, without a shred of doubt, that that indeed was going to happen. Putin spoke again scathingly about the diplomatic history relating to Ukraine. He spoke about the endless succession of Western deceptions that have been carried out over the course of the Ukraine conflict, which, as far as the Russians are concerned, began with the Maidan seizure of power in February 2014, which the Russians correctly, by the way, say was unconstitutional. And, well, Putin also said that the Western powers are behaving increasingly aggressively on the high seas, They have been seizing ships carrying Russian cargo. This behaviour is tantamount to piracy. And one of the topics that he discussed with the naval commanders was the role the Russian Navy is going to take in the future in order to prevent this. Now, I should say, one of the interesting parts of Putin's statement about the Russian Navy providing protection for the merchant ships is that for whatever reason, the Kremlin has not provided us with a written transcript of these words. At least, I cannot find it. Whether this was a decision made by Putin or by Peskov, or whether the Navy people themselves asked for it because a discussion of plans about how the protection would be provided followed. That, by the way, is my guess. I don't know. But I do mention the fact that when I went to the Kremlin's website, I couldn't find there any mention of this, of these words, where Putin speaks of the behaviour of the Western powers as tantamount to piracy. But there is no doubt that he did say this, because you can see video footage of Putin saying it, and it has been reported across the entire Russian media space. Anyway, that Putin is talking about providing naval escorts for Russian merchant ships, and the detailed plans are being created in order to do this, also, to my mind, tells me that he is in no mood to compromise, certainly not on the topic of a ceasefire in the sky. It is completely contrary. It would be completely contrary to his tone and behaviour if he were to do so. On the contrary, I would say that all of the words, all of the discussion that took place between Putin and the naval officers shows a man, Putin, who is now focused exclusively on achieving a military outcome to the war. He also said something else, which is consistent with reports that came out of Bloomberg a few days ago, that over the course of discussions with the Americans, the Russians have made clear that the territorial compromises that Putin was prepared to make in Anchorage back in August have now been taken back, and that the Russians now insist that not only must the Ukrainians entirely withdraw from Donbass for there to be a cessation of hostilities, but that they must withdraw from Zaporozhye and Kherson regions as well, and that all of the territories that the Russians now control in Kharkiv and Sumy region should continue to remain under Russian control. This is what Bloomberg said, and a comment that Putin made seems to me to be consistent with this. This is what Putin said, and I'm surprised again that it has attracted so little attention. He said this: "You know from history, Ukraine has always been divided into left bank and right bank Ukraine. For those who don't know, left bank Ukraine is eastern Ukraine, all of Ukraine east of the Dnieper River, including Donbass, Kharkiv, Sumy, Chernihiv regions, Zaporozhye region, Kherson region, east of the Dnieper. Ukraine has always been divided into left bank and right bank Ukraine. Left bank Ukraine has always been considered not just Russia oriented, but part of Russia. Left bank Ukraine has always been considered part of Russia. And then he goes again back into a long discussion of what happened in Lenin's day, how Donbass, the representatives of Donbass in Lenin's time said that they wanted to become a part of the Russian Soviet Federative Socialist Republic, which Lenin had just created. But Lenin, on receiving requests from members of the Communist Party in Western Ukraine, agreed with them and reversed the decision and decided that Donbass should instead be part of Soviet Ukraine. So anyway, Putin went into all of that. But it is his point, his comment about left bank Ukraine, that is, for me, again, the interesting one. Now, I ought to say that the expressions left bank and right bank Ukraine, from my understanding, go back to the 16th and 17th century, especially to the 17th century, when the territory which we now call Ukrainian, which lay east of the Dnieper River, was part of the Russian Empire, ruled by the Tsar, at that time in Moscow, and the territory west of the Dnieper River was ruled by the King of Poland, with Kiev itself being controlled in those days by Poland, by the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth. So these expressions, left bank and right bank Ukraine, have a very long history, and they are still revived from time to time. I remember reading some years ago Stalin discussing with his generals during the Second World War plans to cross the Dnieper, and Stalin at that time was also talking about left and right bank Ukraine. So all of Ukraine east of the Dnieper, according to Putin, is and always has been Russia. It is an anomaly that it was ever made part of Ukraine, the Soviet Republic of Ukraine. It is an anomaly that that happened at all. Just to say. And of course, if we're going back to the 17th century, then the area of Ukraine's Black Sea coast, which is of course west of the Dnieper River, the part which Ukraine still controls, Odessa, Nikolaev, Izmail, all of these places, they were not under Russian or Polish control when the expressions left and right bank Ukraine were being used, because in the 17th century they were controlled by the Ottoman Empire. They were conquered and absorbed into the Russian Empire by Catherine the Great and her general and possible husband, Prince Potemkin, at the end of the 18th century. So Putin can validly say, and has in fact said in the past, that this territory, Odessa, and all the regions around it, they too are and have been historically a part of Russia. So we could see that the scope of Russian thinking about the territory in Ukraine that Russia would be justified to control is now continuously expanding. In fact, I can remember that back last year, Putin said that any part of Ukrainian territory that the Russians capture is legitimately Russian, because, as he put it, Ukraine is ours. It's always been ours. It's part of the three branches of the Rus people, the Russians, the Belarusians, and the Ukrainians, who ultimately form a single whole. And that Putin continues to think in this way is further illustrated by some other things that he said over the course of his meeting with the naval officers. He said that back in the 1940s, during the Second World War, in fact, Stalin attached to Ukraine as a sort of gift various territories that had belonged to other countries in Eastern Europe, to Poland, Hungary, Romania. I think he mentioned one other country, but I forget which one. And he said that Stalin obviously envisaged all of this when all of these territories, Ukraine, Russia, were part of a single state, which is, of course, the Soviet Union, and that Stalin would never have imagined a situation such as the one that exists today, in which Ukraine is independent and is engaged in a war against Russia. But Putin went on to say that he expects that one day in time, maybe not next year, but in 5 years, 10 years, 15 years' time, all of these historical anomalies will be corrected and all of these territories will be returned to their proper owners, Hungary, Romania, Poland, and whichever was the other country that I don't remember. Now, again, that suggests Putin wanting to turn the clock back to where he thinks it should have been after the end of the Russian Civil War, with a border which would in effect be the same as the Soviet border that existed up to the time of the Soviet annexations in 1939. Well, that, of course, if we follow through with that logic, would mean that Ukraine, all of Ukraine, apart from its westernmost regions, Ukraine, including cities like Kiev, obviously, but Vinnytsia, Zhytomyr, all of these places, they would all fall under the control of Russia again. Now, I don't know whether these are worked out plans or whether this is again Putin wearing his historian's hat and thinking ahead as to what will probably eventually happen. But again, to repeat, this kind of talk does not seem to me to be the kind of talk one would expect from somebody who is in any measure interested in any sort of compromise, certainly not the sort of compromise which would involve agreeing to a ceasefire, or rather a no-fly zone for the Russian Air Force over Ukraine. I do not think that Westerners fully grasp the extent to which Putin himself is guided by history in terms of his conflict, the conflict in Ukraine. A history which is not shared only by him. We are talking about the territory, the territory that very large numbers of Russians believe and consider to be historically a part of their country. Anyway, there it is. So we're going to get this stillborn, as I predict, diplomatic initiative from the Americans. I think that there is a further point to make here. The Americans, as I said, still continue to imagine that they can continue to coerce or the Russians from the sky or in some way in order to get the Russians to somehow soften their demands, and better still, to accept American ones. It is a mistake the Americans make time after time against every adversary that they come up against. They made this mistake with the North Koreans, the North Vietnamese, the Iranians, and of course, the Russians. The Russians are not going to concede these things. It's not only that they care about this war and consider it existential for themselves. It's not merely that the Russians also, by now, no longer trust the Americans on anything. I discussed 2 or 3 programs ago Lavrov's comments about American duplicity at Anchorage, the comments he made after his meeting with Rubio, and his intense anger about this. It's not just that the Russians no longer trust the West. They don't trust Donald Trump and this administration either. And, well, given the record of the administration in the year and a half that it has been in office, who can blame them? So the Russians have no trust. And besides, there is one final overriding factor that all but guarantees that the Russians are going to reject these proposals, and that is that the Russians are winning the war. Now, a country that is on course to victory, that senses that victory is just over the horizon, is not going to be in any mood to compromise on its core demands. Again, it's difficult to see why in the West people have so much trouble understanding this. Of course, some people in the West believe that the Russians are not winning the war, that the Russians are actually losing the war. But anybody who pays close attention to the realities on the front lines can see that this is wrong. And, well, it is to that that I will now turn. First of all, I should say that both sides, both the Russians and the Ukrainians, conducted strikes against each other last night. The Ukrainians launched hundreds of drones towards Belgorod, and beyond Belgorod, they appear to have been trying to move again towards Moscow. From what I can tell, pretty much all of the drones were shot down, and that part of the Ukrainian drone offensive ended in total failure. The other operation that was carried out, drone attack that the Ukrainians carried out, was towards the city of Rostov, which is within Russia, but also relatively close to the 2014 border. In fact, it is further away from territory that the Ukrainians control, because the territory to the west of the old border between Russia and Ukraine is made up of Donbass, which is now mostly controlled by the Russians. But anyway, Rostov also is not far away. It is also an important target for the Ukrainians because there is a major air base there, and Rostov is a historic military town. It was, by the way, very much in the past a center of the Cossacks in southern Russia, in the Kuban region of southern Russia. But beyond that, it is also the location, it is also where the location of the headquarters of the Russian forces that are conducting the offensive in Ukraine, the Russian operation in Ukraine. It is in Rostov where they are apparently located. During his mutiny in the summer of 2023, Prigozhin's force briefly encircled and partially occupied this headquarters, just to say. So one can understand why there's been a Ukrainian drone attack there. From what I can tell, again, the Ukrainians were mostly unsuccessful attacking any military facilities in Rostov. But there are reports from Russia that some drone struck some building or civilian complex, and that a number of civilians have been killed. Anyway, that appears to be the sum total of what Ukraine's big drone attack on Russia achieved last night. The Russians, by contrast, achieved much more. More massive strikes against Odessa, more destructions of gas filling stations, warehouses, other complexes across central and eastern Ukraine. Massive damage done to Ukraine's logistics and what's left of its industry. And bear in mind that all of this is happening on top of the collapse of Ukraine's maritime trade, which must be putting enormous pressure on Ukraine's domestic economy. I suspect that before very long, we're going to see further demands from the Ukrainians for further funding. And I also suspect that before very long, we're going to see inflationary pressures in Ukraine, which, by the way, are already heightening. I expect to see inflationary pressures in Ukraine start to get worse. Anyway, that's the situation in the sky, but it is on the ground that the more dramatic news is now increasingly coming, because the Russian offensives, and I think we perhaps can speak of several taking place along the conflict line, are all now gaining further and further momentum. I spoke in my last two programs about the ongoing collapse of Ukrainian defenses in and around the town of Dobropilia in north in western Donbass. In fact, it's essentially the last, the furthest westward city in Donbass still under Ukrainian control. And we have had, over the last couple of days, reports first about the fall of the important fortified town of Belitskaya, and then of the important fortified village of Shevchenko. Well, this morning, all sorts of scattered reports have appeared that the Russian army has broken further, deeper into Dobropilia itself. And there are even some reports that speak of the Russians storming Dobropilia and of their having reached the center of the town. Now, I've seen no confirmation of any of this from the Russian Defense Ministry. There's certainly no drone footage to confirm this. There's no word about this yet from Rodovka or other Russian news media outlets. But it does seem as if the pressure on Dobropilia is indeed intensifying, and that the situation for the Ukrainians in Dobropilia is becoming critical. Dobropilia is a town. Before the war, it numbered 28,000. It had a population of 28,000 people. At least that was the estimate. So it's obviously not a village. It's not a full-fledged city. But it is not an insignificant or small place. It is, however, located in the middle of steppe land. There are no other big urban settlements around it. It is not part of some great urban sprawl, which has been true of the rest of Donbass. So there are no other towns or cities held by Ukraine where Ukrainian troops can be positioned and send supplies to their friends, to their comrades, defending Dobropilia. There are no obvious locations where Ukrainian troops in Dobropilia can retreat to, except the open steppe. I would have thought that this would be now an extremely difficult place to defend. The Russians now control all the other big urban areas there. They control Pokrovsk, Mirnograd, Rodinsk, Belitska, and the large and important village of Gryshino that they captured some time ago. So I have discussed in several programs the importance of Dobropilia, that if the Russians capture Dobropilia, there are no natural or even made defenses around it. There are no towns or villages nearby, and the Russians can advance north, straight north from Dobropilia, and start cutting off the Ukrainian supply lines from the west to Slavyansk and Kramatorsk, potentially putting the tens of thousands of Ukrainian troops that are trying to defend these two cities into a cauldron. So that is happening. The other thing that is happening in this area is that it seems that the Russians are now well inside the small town of Alexeyevo-Druzhivka, which is to the south of Druzhivka itself. There are reports that they've also reached the center of this town, which lies immediately to the north of Konstantinovka. Again, if this is true, then the defences, the Ukrainian defences, are collapsing extremely fast. And, well, the fall of this further town, small town, would not perhaps be decisive. There are still the bigger places further north, Kramatorsk, Slavyansk, and of course Druzhivka itself. But it does not speak well for the stability of the defences in the fortified line, the last big fortified line in Donbass. And there continue to be reports about Russian troops having entered the Slavyansk thermal power plant and a fighting taking place on its territory. And apparently, I haven't seen this, satellite footage has been obtained of Nikolaevka, the village immediately to the west of Slavyansk. Lots of fire anomalies in this town. Some apparently think that this is the result of bombing by the Russians, by the Russian Air Force, which would imply very intense bombing of this relatively small place. But of course, it might also be consistent with something else, which is a fighting going on in Nikolaevka, with the Russians now also having entered this town and fighting taking place as the Russians work to force the Ukrainians out of it. And further south, in Zaporozhye region, early this morning, the Russians announced the capture of another village to the west, northwest of Ternovata. This is in eastern Zaporozhye. Ternovata was captured by the Russians in the autumn of last year. The Ukrainians have made many attempts to recapture it. They've sometimes claimed that they have recaptured it. As far as I'm aware, it has always remained under Russian control. But there is no doubt that the Ukrainians have conducted sustained counterattacks in the area of Ternovata and have attempted to recapture Ternovata. The point about Ternovata is that its capture undermines the integrity of the eastern defences of around Orekhov. And if the Russians have pushed west beyond Ternovata and have captured another village to the west of Ternovata, and there is apparently drone footage, film which confirms this, showing Russian soldiers in this village, then it's not just a case of Ternovata being securely under Russian control, but of the further disintegration of Ukrainian defences in this area as well, or Orekhov's defences in this area as well. Now, some, by the way, are linking this operation with the claims that which I mentioned in my programme yesterday about a group of 1,000 Ukrainian troops having been taken into a cauldron somewhere on the conflict line. Some maps have created a zone of apparent Ukrainian control to the east of Ternovata, which Russian control of Ternovata and of this further village would have in effect closed. It may be that there is indeed a cauldron here, but I prefer to go here with the analysis of Scott of Calibrated, that in this open steppe land, front lines are very permeable, and I doubt that there is any large Ukrainian force in this area, and I suspect that whatever Ukrainian forces there are still routes for them to withdraw. I continue to believe that the far more likely place for the cauldron, the entrapment of the Ukrainian troops, is in Lima, in northern Donbass. The Russian Defense Ministry has released many commentaries about how a Ukrainian force in Liman is unable to retreat, that it can't cross the river that is near Liman. And there was a long piece in Redovka about this very thing. And it seems to me that if there is a cauldron anywhere on the front lines, that is most likely where it is. There have also been further reports of more Russian advances in the Kharkiv and Sumy areas, with more territory falling under control, Russian control. But I am not fully up to date with all of this, just saying. Now, Ukraine has been through a period of political turmoil over the last few weeks. Zelensky, following complaints from the uniformed military led by General Sirsky, sacked Mikhailo Fyodorov, the Ukrainian defense minister, who was, if you like, the front man of Ukraine's drone offensive. Sirsky and the commanders, exasperated by a drone offensive that was diverting resources away from the soldiers on the front lines towards towards a drone offensive which was achieving very little, complained to Zelensky about Fyodorov. There continues to be a story that General Sirsky said to Zelensky, "It's either Fyodorov or me. You can't have both of us. One of us must go if you're going to keep the other." I think it is much, much more likely, as I've discussed previously, that what really happened was that the Ukrainian uniformed military told Zelensky that there has to be a change of approach to the war, that there must be no dependence on these fancy drone attacks, which are actually achieving nothing. Actually, they've not achieved nothing. They've achieved a terrible result for Ukraine. They've provided the Russians with the excuse to blockade Odessa and to destroy and close all of Ukraine's Black Sea ports. So anyway, the uniformed military told Zelensky there must be no more of this. This is all nonsense at the end of the day. It's all PR. If things go on as they are, with our army exhausted and overstretched, critically short of trained infantry, then at some point parts of the front line are going to start to collapse. We need more men and more resources to hold the lines in Donbass, in northeastern Ukraine, in Kharkiv, in Sumy region, in Zaporozhye. Without more men and more resources, we simply cannot do it. And faced by the united demand from the military that Fyodorov go, Zelensky had no choice but to force Fyodorov to resign, in effect to dismiss him. Well, as we know, what then happened was that protests were organised around Ukraine from the Western, the Western supporting NGO based people in Ukraine, demanding Fyodorov's reinstatement and Sirsky's sacking. And after a period of several days in which the West appeared to hesitate, the Western media engaged in an organized campaign demanding the sacking of the Soviet era soldier still in charge of Ukraine's forces, General Sirsky. And at that point, of course, General Sirsky did indeed have to go. And he's now been replaced by General Dropati. But General Dropati, who is very much, I should say, identified with the hardline nationalist element within Ukraine, he said things about Russians, which I'm not going to repeat on this program. I found them distressing, shall I say. Anyway, General Dropati has taken a very strange approach to this accumulating story of disaster across the front lines. You would have expected him to dash to Dobropylia to see what he could do to take control of the situation there, or to go to Kharkiv region and to take charge of the situation there, or to do the same in Zaporozhye. Sirsky, to his credit, always used to do that. But at the moment, at least, Dropati seems to be more focused on something entirely different. He has set up a massive audit, as he says, to find out what the true situation of the Ukrainian army across the front lines really is. And, well, at some levels, I think that is probably a good idea. I suspect that many Ukrainian brigades are far below strength, and that the situation in the front lines is patchy. There is no doubt that there has been a massive amount of misreporting about the state of the war by Ukrainian commanders, who have been somewhat fearful of both Zelensky and Sirsky, and have been unwilling to tell the truth about the situation on the front lines, which is why we get fairy tales such as the continuing one that Konstantinovka remains under Ukrainian control. But I can't help but think that launching an audit of this kind in the middle of a military crisis is the kind of step you would expect from a commander who is out of his depth and is trying to create the appearance of activity in place of activity itself. Also, of course, it serves another purpose. It means that as the situation on the front lines goes from bad to critical, the results of the audit will enable General Dropati to put the blame on his predecessor, General Sirski, who, of course, to some extent, created the situation for himself by publishing a resignation statement that made the ludicrous assertion that Sirski was handing over to Dropati a strong army which had regained the initiative across the front lines. Anyway, there it is. This is where I think we are in the war. Very strange diplomatic activity taking place. Zelensky, of course, is about to go to the United States to attend Lindsey Graham's funeral. He will no doubt speak there with Donald Trump. And of course, as I discussed in my program of a few days ago, Zelensky ordered this strike on the Iranian ship in the Caspian Sea. The Iranians are furious about this. They have threatened Ukraine with counterstrikes, reminding Ukraine that Iran has missiles which are fully capable of striking targets inside Ukraine itself if launched from Iranian territory. And Araghchi, very interestingly, also telephoned Kaya Kallas, the European foreign minister, to complain to her about this terrible behavior by the Ukrainians in carrying out this strike. Well, all of this is very interesting, and it is also consistent, of course, with what Zelensky has been repeatedly trying to do, which is to try to merge the two wars, the war in Ukraine and the war in Iran, and persuade the Americans that their enemies are his enemies, and his enemies are their enemies, and that the war between the United States and Iran and the war between Ukraine and Russia are all part of some great epic struggle between the West and the dark forces to the East, which are working to try to undermine Western hegemony and all that. But I think there's something further which I would say about the attack on the Caspian Sea ship, which so far, as far as I'm aware, nobody has discussed. How did Zelensky, how did the Ukrainians know the ship was there? The Caspian is a big body of water. How did the Ukrainians know to send a drone or drones to reach the Caspian and to strike at a ship, a specific Iranian ship in the Caspian Sea? They must have obtained the data from someone. I don't believe Ukraine has the means to track the movement of Iranian ships in the Caspian Sea. Some of the European powers do have satellite systems, capabilities, but I don't believe they stretch to this level. The information about the whereabouts of this Iranian ship in the Caspian Sea can only have come from the Americans. Someone in the United States, presumably with Trump's authorization, decided to pass on to Zelensky information about the whereabouts of the ship, the Iranian ship, so that the Iranians could strike it. So that the Ukrainians could strike it. And now, of course, after this successful example of cooperation, as Zelensky will spin it, he's going to come to Washington and he's going to tell the Americans, you see what we can do. We have all of these extraordinary, impressive drone capabilities. We can strike ships in the Caspian Sea if you simply give us the target coordinates. And we are the masters of drone war, and all you need to do is to provide us with unlimited assistance, and we will provide you with the same assistance, which you can then in turn yourselves use against Iran. And Zelensky is selling the same fantasy to the British. I said some days ago that nobody should expect any change of policy from the new Burnham government towards Ukraine. And in fact, it seems that Burnham and Zelensky are going to meet very soon, and they're going to sign off on a brilliant new plan to build a drone factory in Britain to produce drones for Ukraine. However, the drones will use British licensed technology. The fact that this creates an obvious target for the Russians, if the Russians ever decide to act in a somewhat less restrained way, doesn't appear to worry the British over much. Perhaps they welcome this, though given the dreadful state of the British armed forces, I can't imagine why the British are so complacent about this. But we see how early on, in the first days of his premiership, Britain's new Prime Minister, Andy Burnham, is following in the footsteps of his illustrious predecessor, Sir Keir Starmer, and is also intent on embracing the Zelensky curse. I will be interested to see, by the way, whether Burnham and Zelensky hug each other in the same way that Zelensky and Starmer used to do. So anyway, this is part of the fantasy that Zelensky is selling, but it is a fantasy. Some Ukrainian drones, as I say, do get through and do actual damage. But the reality is, as we saw with the Ukrainian drone strike last night, that the damage that has actually been done is limited, and that it is not having any major effect either in causing Russian policy to change, or in creating, nurturing instability in Russia ahead of the elections. Well, there it is. Now, let me conclude this program with the further discussions that are taking place about the conflict in Iran and where it is going. There was an extraordinary, melancholy editorial in the Daily Telegraph in Britain, talking about the necessity now of bringing the conflict with Iran to an end. In some ways, the editorial made me choke, actually. It said, ending the war, the Iran war, is in all our interests. Trump may have started this war, and it is continuing due to Tehran's intransigence, but the West's prosperity hinges on its conclusion. And then the rest of the article says that it is now imperative to bring the war to an end because the United States is running out of precision weapons and the world is running out of fuel, all of which is true, by the way. I have personal reason to know that fuel shortages are now starting to affect the situation in Europe, specifically shortages of aviation fuel. Just saying. Anyway, the Daily Telegraph is saying all of this, and when you read the editorial carefully, you will find no admission anywhere in any part of this editorial or anywhere else in this, well, I will continue to refer to it as a newspaper, though perhaps another more uncomplimentary term might be more appropriate. Anyway, you will never find any admission that for as long as I can remember, no other newspaper in Britain has been more relentless, more enthusiastic, more single-minded, and more focused on persuading the United States to launch a war to achieve regime change in Iran. And no other newspaper in Britain was so zealous as peddling the fantasy that Iran was a house of cards, that its air defences had been destroyed, that the Iranian people were prepared to rise up and overthrow their government, that the offensive power of Iran's ballistic missiles had been overstated and was exhausted, that Iran's drones were ineffectual, and that an attack on Iran was guaranteed total and complete success. As they say, victory has many fathers, but defeat is an orphan. When you read the editorial, the entire blame for the failure in the war is placed on one individual, who is, of course, Donald Trump. Now, Donald Trump today is denying this, but I have no doubt, following articles which have appeared in the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal, that what has forced America to end its attacks on Iran is the depletion of its weapons inventories. This is the first time that this has happened, from my knowledge, in American history. I do not recall a single war since the American Civil War of the 1860s in which the United States has been forced to stop a war because it has run out of the means to wage it. It is even worse this time than it was back in April when we had the previous pause in the war, because at least that pause was negotiated between Iran and the United States, with Pakistan acting as an intermediary. This time, the Iranians have agreed to nothing. It was the United States unilaterally, without announcing the fact in advance, which simply chose to pause its attacks. And it was only over the next few days that contradictory explanations for the decision began to be published. And it was only gradually that we got what I have no doubt is the real reason, that the United States has in effect exhausted or come close to exhausting its weapons stockpile. Now, what comes next in the Middle East, I am not sure. For the moment, the Strait of Hormuz remains shut. It seems the Red Sea is not shut. The Iranians are saying, though, that if there is a renewed American attack on them, the Houthis have confirmed that they will shut the Red Sea. The Yemenis are trying to negotiate with the Iranians a reopening of the Strait of Hormuz. I am not sure why the Iranians would want to do it at this time. And we have proof now that the Iranians have indeed mined the Strait of Hormuz with sea mines, because a tanker that tried to pass through the Strait of Hormuz was prevented from doing so after it struck a mine and received severe damage. But putting aside what are already the important implications for the Persian Gulf and for the duel between the United States and Iran, of the revelation that America has run out of weapons, the fact that America went to war and ran out of weapons is going to have global consequences. I read another article, this time in Reuters, about how US industry is coming back and is telling the administration that it is unable to meet the president's target to make the US self-sufficient in rare earths by 2027. In fact, it seems that barely any progress here has been made. American factories still seem unable to build up the necessary means to produce weapons. Contrast that with Russia, where the industry minister, Minister Alikhanov, has said that Russia has increased production of air defense missiles and weapons, other air defense weapons, several fold since last year. The Russians continue to have that surge capability. The Americans do not. Well, this is where I'm going to finish this program today. Let me remind you, you can find all our programs on our various platforms, Locals, Rumble, X, and Substack. You can support our work via Patreon and Subscribestar, and by going to our shop, links under this video. Last but not least, if you've liked this video, please remember to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel. That's me for today. More from me soon. Have a very good day.